Could I invite you now to turn your attention to the Word of God, reading together from the book of the prophet Daniel, chapter 7, which is around page 862 of the Bibles that you'll find in the seats in front of you. We've been reading through the book of Daniel for a number of weeks now, and a lot of people, when they read Daniel or books about Daniel or Bible studies in Daniel, get to chapter 6 and have a great time talking about lion's den and fiery furnaces and the food in the chapter 1 and all the other things that happen, and then they get to chapter 7 and stop, or else the first 150 pages of the book are in chapter 1 to 6 and the last 10 pages are in chapter 7 to 12. And that's because from chapter 7 onwards it all gets very strange. What has been day-to-day adventures and excitement and things that we can understand and relate to, and we can imagine being like Daniel or imagine being like the king and these things happening to us, and make relatively simple applications from the stories. When we come to chapter 7 to 12, it all turns into weird and wonderful dreams, mystery and fantasy and confusion. And the temptation is to read it and to say, I cannot understand a word of this or make any sense of it, and flick through to the end of the book and go on to read the Sermon on the Mount instead. And that's fine, but it's obviously not what the writer of the book of Daniel wanted us to do. In fact, it's the exact opposite of what they wanted. The way the book is set out, chapters 1 to 6 are there to establish Daniel as a trustworthy, reliable, God-sent man of wisdom and vision. And we see him influencing the king, and we see him being miraculously saved, and we see him changing the Babylonian Empire to which he has been sent as an exile. And we think to ourselves, there is a man I could trust. There is a man I would listen to. And that sets the platform for the second half of the book, chapter 7 to 12, when we hear about the dreams and the visions and the interpretation and his understanding of what all this was about. So chapter 6 is setting the scene. 1 to 6 is setting the scene. Chapter 7 onwards is where it really matters, because it's no longer just history, it's prophecy and it's vision. And it's the way the world works. And it's an insight into the nature and the character of God. So this is where it matters. And this is where we have to sit up and pay attention. Daniel's vision of the four beasts. In the first year that Belshazzar was king of Babylonia. Now Belshazzar was the king we read about last week in chapter 5. Towards the end of the Babylonian Empire, so around 550 to 539 BC, thereabouts, the king who saw the writing on the wall and was killed in the night and replaced by the Persians. In the first year that Belshazzar was king of Babylonia, I had a dream. And I saw a vision in the night, and I wrote the dream down, and this is the record of what I saw that night. Winds were blowing from all directions and lashing the surface of the ocean. And four huge beasts came up out of the ocean, each one different from the others. The first one looked like a lion, but had wings like an eagle. And while I was watching, the wings were torn off. The beast was lifted up and made to stand upright, and then a human mind was given to it. The second beast looked like a bear standing on its hind legs, and it was holding three ribs between its teeth, and a voice said to it, "Go on, eat as much as you can." And while I was watching, another beast appeared, and it looked like a leopard, but on its back were four wings like the wings of a bird, and it had four heads, and it had a look of authority about it. And as I was watching, a fourth beast appeared. It was powerful, horrible, terrifying. With its huge iron teeth, it crushed its victims, and then it trampled on them. And unlike the other beasts, it had 10 horns. And while I was staring at the horns, I saw a little horn coming up among the others. It tore out three of the horns that were already there, and this horn had human eyes and a mouth that was boasting proudly. And while I was looking, thrones were put in place. And one who had been living there forever, or the Ancient of Days, sat down on one of the thrones. His clothes were white as snow, and his hair was like pure wool. His throne, mounted on fiery wheels, was blazing with fire, and a stream of fire was pouring out from it. And there were many thousands of people there to serve him, and millions of people stood before him. And the court began its session, and the books were opened. And while I was looking, I could still hear the little horn bragging and boasting. But as I watched, the fourth beast was killed, and its body was thrown into the flames and destroyed. And the other beasts had their power taken away, but they were permitted to go on living for a limited time. And during this vision in the night, I saw what looked like a human being, literally a son of man. And he was approaching me, surrounding by clouds. And he went up to the Ancient of Days, the one who had been living forever, and was presented to him. And he was given authority, honor, and royal power, so that the people of all nations, races, and languages would serve him. And his authority would last forever, and his kingdom would never end. The visions I saw alarmed me, and I was deeply disturbed. So I went up to one of those standing there and asked him to explain it all, and so he told me the meaning. He said, "The four huge beasts are four empires which will arise on earth, and the people of the supreme God will receive royal power and keep it forever and ever." Well, then I wanted to know more about the fourth beast, which was not like any of the others, the terrifying beast which crushed its victims with its bronze claws and iron teeth and then trampled on them. And I wanted to know about the 10 horns on its head and the horn that had come up afterwards and had made 3 of the horns fall. It had eyes and a mouth and was boasting proudly. It was more terrifying than any of the others. And while I was looking, that horn made war on God's people and conquered them. Then the one who had been living forever came and pronounced judgment in favor of the people of the supreme God. And the time had arrived for God's people to receive royal power. And this is the explanation I was given. The fourth beast is a fourth empire that will be on the earth and will be different from all other empires. It will crush the whole earth and trample it down. The 10 horns are 10 kings who will rule that empire. And then another king will appear who will be very different from the earlier ones and will overthrow 3 kings. And he will speak against the supreme God and oppress God's people and try to change their religious laws and festivals. And God's people will be under his power for 3.5 years. And then the heavenly court will sit in judgment and take away his power and destroy him completely. And the power and greatness of all the kingdoms of earth will be given to the people of the supreme God. Their royal power will never end, and all rulers on earth will serve and obey them. And this is the end of the account, and I was so frightened that I turned pale and kept everything to myself. Daniel's vision. A vision of the sea, to begin with. Someone I met this week was telling me that the Christmas shopping crowds are now out in Oxford Street. Recession or no recession, the crowds are there, and the only way to get through the heaving mass of people is to put your head down and your shoulder down and get your elbows out as sharp as possible and plunge into the heaving mass and force your way through. Maybe you've been there and done that. Or maybe you've watched a sports crowd on TV or been to a huge stadium where all you can see is a sea of great faces and a great wave of sound sweeps over you when something exciting is happening. And you've looked at the crowd and you've wondered who they all are. Where do they all come from? What brings them together and what makes them behave like this? Or maybe you've sometime looked down from an aeroplane over a great vast expanse of a city, a huge ocean of life, and seen all these thousands or hundreds of thousands of homes now reduced to the size of the cabin window. and the vastness of the human race has struck you once again. Crowds of people, crowds of strangers, ebbing and flowing with the tides of fashion, no telling what moves them or changes their minds. Sometimes whipped up into a storm by a fury of passion or protest. And you see these vast numbers of people, and it makes you as an individual feel very small and insignificant. Especially if the crowd was to turn against you, there would be nothing that you could do. Well, that's what Daniel in exile is made to see and made to feel at the start of this dream. He knows that he is a pawn in a pagan land. And he has this vision of the world he lives in and sees it as a stormy sea at night, in verse 2. Winds were blowing from all directions and lashing the surface of the ocean. All the people round about him, the vast millions in the empire, with no way to control them and nowhere to shelter when the storm comes against him. And then up out of this restless, heaving sea of humanity, four beasts emerge, representing, we're later told in verse 17, four empires on earth. So the ruling or controlling influences over the people who make up the ocean itself. And each one of the four beasts is more beastly than the one before. And you can imagine how Daniel would have felt and why he says twice in his account that he was frightened or turned pale and couldn't understand, exposed and feeling futile in the face of this vastness and these particular horrors. You can understand Daniel feeling perhaps like the missionary who goes overseas to a foreign land where countless millions of people have never heard the good news of Jesus Christ and where it's maybe even illegal to possess a copy of the Bible, let alone to preach the gospel. And you'd feel the passions of the people very often aroused against all that you stand for and feel entirely at their mercy. Or maybe even just like a Christian witness in Scotland today, where the response to the Church of Jesus Christ is like a turning tide, turning away from mere absence from church through ignorance of what we believe to outright opposition to all our attempts to share our faith and preach the gospel. And nothing we try to do seems able to change that. Nor does there seem to be anywhere for us to take shelter. So we are perhaps like Daniel as he looks out over the sea. And then the first beast emerges, and to begin with, it maybe isn't quite as bad as it could be, because Daniel recognizes the first beast in verse 4. The lion with wings, eagles on his back. It's the badge of Babylon. He understands that. What is more is that as he watches it, it becomes less beastly in verse 4. The wings are torn off. The beast rises from all fours to stand upright. And it's given a human mind. Its treatment of people, its way of thinking and behaving becomes more humane. And Daniel would probably recall how under his influence the former emperor Nebuchadnezzar, who began life with savage brutality, saw how he was changed and tamed. We read about that in chapter 4 last week, how God first of all reduced the king from arrogant boasting and selfish pride to the status of a tethered animal eating grass in the fields. But then after 7 years, the king raised his eyes to heaven again and looked up to the Lord, and the Lord restored his sanity. In chapter 4, verse 36, and along with that, his honor and his majesty, turning his pride to humility before the Lord, and his boasting to worship and to praise. And you can imagine Daniel at that stage thinking to himself that the tide has turned. that the nation, the empire, is changing for the better. That not only has God worked this wonderful miracle in a way that nobody could deny the evidence, but he has also now put in place the leader of the nation, the emperor himself, as a man of faith who has learned to pray to God, who has been converted. Surely others would now follow suit and Israel's fortunes would be restored and the kingdom of God would appear on earth in a wonderful and exciting way. But by the time we get to chapter 7 in the first year of Belshazzar, 20 years after Nebuchadnezzar's death, that change in fortunes, that beginning of a revival, was now no more than a memory. And instead we have Nebuchadnezzar's successor, a proud and worthless man, himself about to lose his kingdom to others more violent and less scrupulous than he. And the prospects look worse than ever. And that is how the dream unfolds. The first beast followed in verse 5 by the greater size and strength of a bear, representing the Persian Empire, devouring its prey. And then in verse 6, the third beast, the swiftness of the leopard, representing Alexander the Great, who swept across the continent from Greece, sweeping to victory and conquering everything that lay in his path. And finally, in verse 7, the fourth beast, Rome, whom Daniel cannot find any animal that he recognizes to compare it with, because it's like nothing he's ever seen before. Its crushing power and horror and terror simply defies description. And so he is reminded that what seemed to be the first step in the right direction, the humanizing of the first beast, was only a brief interlude that was going very much against the flow. And so we have this faithful, godly man, Daniel, who lives in a world that knows something of God's blessing. He can look back on times of answered prayer, where people of faith have some encouragement and can point to changed lives and even miracles performed, but where each of these blessings seem to be brief interludes, each forward step is followed by several back, short-term gains but long-term losses, undoubted experience of individuals coming to saving faith, but at the same time vast crowds of people turning their backs on God. That is the sea that Daniel looked out upon, and very much the sea in which the Church of Christ seems to be heading for shipwreck today. But then Daniel is able to understand that there is another way of looking at these things. And it comes in chapter 9. Verse 9 of chapter 7. While I was looking, perhaps transfixed by the horror of the fourth beast rising up out of the surface of the ocean, but while I was looking, my sight was distracted to another area of activity. And I saw thrones were put in place. And one who had been living forever, the Ancient of Days, sat down on one of the thrones. And Daniel recognizes that a court is in session and judgment is just about to begin. And what is the judge like? The judge himself is just. He's had lots of experience already of emperors who do what suits them best. But this judge is different. His clothes are white as snow, and his hair was like pure wool. And his jurisdiction was far-reaching because his mobile throne was upon fiery wheels. So not one fixed location and the people on the fringes would get away with what they wanted out of his sight, but a mobile judge who could go wherever he wanted. And the judgment he gave was swift and decisive. No partial fines payable by installments, or sentence delayed for background reports, or people being given prison sentences and then early parole. But the judgment consisted of a stream of fire in verse 10, which flowed from the throne into a lake in front of him where the condemned would be destroyed. And he knew what he was doing, because in verse 10, as the court began its session, the books were opened. And these books representing an account of everything that had happened and everything that had been done, so that there was no uncertainty or ignorance in the judge. And millions of people stood before him. So that vast, untamed, heaving sea of humanity that Daniel had been looking at was suddenly brought to order and made to stand in line before the judge. And from this new perspective, things begin to look different. And even the beasts look small. And the centuries of empire that they represent seem short. And the victims of brutal injustice with no one to stand up for them suddenly become the servants gathered round the throne in verse 10. And those brief interludes of blessing that Daniel remembers suddenly seem to be the pattern of things to come. Of course, not everybody can see that new perspective. It's only given to Daniel in his vision. And even within the vision itself, while Daniel was dreaming, ordinary life was going on around him. And as the crowd was being called to order, there was at least one who didn't care and wasn't intimidated by the throne that now towered over him. In verse 11, the little horn was bragging and boasting. And that little horn is a close-up view of the driving force behind the final form of the fourth and most terrible of all the beasts. Utterly unfazed by the presence of God. And you can just picture him standing there saying, "What's this all a fuss about? Who's that old man sitting up there? What does he think he's going to do? I'm not going to change my pattern just because someone who calls himself God thinks that he's important." So as judgment was about to begin, the little horn was more sure of himself than ever and treated righteousness with withering scorn. No doubt there were crowds of people around him who took confidence from his bold, brash, boasting and arrogance, and were encouraged and applauded. Nor was it merely boastful words in verse 21 we see, or Daniel sees, "While I was looking, that horn made war on God's people and conquered them." Didn't care that they claimed God as their protection. So in the picture that Daniel has given, it seems that never did the life of faith seem more hopeless, nor the cause of truth more completely lost, than at the very moment when God was just about to act with decisive finality. In verse 11, "While I could still hear the little horn bragging and boasting, the fourth beast was killed." Didn't even put up a struggle. Didn't stand a chance. It was killed and its body was thrown into the flames and destroyed. So there will be nobody taken more by surprise at the judgment of God and the powers of evil than the powers of evil themselves. They just didn't see it coming. But similarly, there is no reason at all why the people of God should be taken by surprise, because this vision has been given and received. So when all that we can see are the beasts, and all we can hear is the bragging and the boasting, then we know that in heaven thrones are being put in place and the books are just about to be opened. But then it seems we're left with a question in the vision. What is the connection between these beasts strutting their stuff on the surface of the ocean and what we see going on in heaven? What is the connection between the old man sitting on his throne and the people under the power of evil? How can he put a stop to the bragging and the boasting and bring the opposition to an end? In the dream, we do not see that happening. We simply hear that it has been done. But then what we see after it has been done, in verse 13, what we see is returning to heaven the one who has done it. The fourth beast has just been killed and thrown into the fire before the throne. And then in verse 13, during this vision of the night, I saw what looked like a human being. Literally, it says, I saw a son of man. And those are the words that Jesus used to describe himself time and time and again in the Gospels. I am a son of man, he says. I am just a human being. So I saw what looked like a human being, nothing out of the ordinary, nothing to make him stand out from the crowds. And that is why when he was down on earth as part of that great seething sea of humanity, we didn't recognize him, we didn't understand what he was doing, but now he's in heaven. Now approaching me, says Daniel, surrounded by the clouds, and then walking past me to the Ancient of Days. He went to the one who had been living forever and was presented to him and was given authority, honor, and royal power. In the book of Revelation, at the end of the New Testament, the Apostle John saw exactly the same thing. Only he understood it a little bit better than Daniel because he had already seen Jesus Christ, God made man, living on earth and ascending into heaven. And he described what he saw in chapter 5, verse 5, the lion from Judah's tribe, the lamb standing in the center of the throne who appeared to have been killed, who in verse 7 took the scroll from the right hand of the one who sits in the throne, as everyone sang in verse 13, to him who sits upon the throne and to the lamb be praise and honor, glory and might forever and ever. You see, Jesus is the connection between what goes on in heaven and what goes on in earth. He is the one who has come to do the will of God. The one who makes the difference and sees that heaven's justice is done. Jesus is the one whose presence on earth all these years ago was not just an interlude of blessing, but a pattern of things to come. And Jesus is the one whom we see in verse 14 of Daniel chapter 7, returning victorious with authority that will last forever to rule a kingdom that will never end. So where does that leave us today as Christians, looking back 2,000 years to the birth of the one who was to come? Daniel was looking into the future and saw past the rise and fall of four mighty empires to the coming of Christ. And he was given his vision and used it to teach his followers to wait with faithful patience. But now we are looking back these 2,000 years and preparing for the anniversary of his coming. And yet still it seems that the beasts are roaming the earth. And still it sounds as if the bragging and the boasting is continuing. And still the struggle for the people of God, not even to make progress, it sometimes feels, but simply to prevent total decline. The struggle goes on. What difference has Jesus made? What we need to remember is this, that back in verse 12, after the fourth beast was killed and its body thrown in the flames, it says the other beasts had their power taken away but were permitted to go on living for a limited time. And in terms of history, that doesn't make any sense, because these three beasts represent the empires of Babylon, Persia, and Greece, who had already been consigned to the history books long before Jesus came in Roman times. But in terms of our experience, of course, it does make perfect sense, because something like those four beasts carries on. Their bold and brash behavior, their terror, and their power. We might not call them Persia or Greece. We might instead call them communism, or colonialism, or the Holocaust, or ethnic cleansing, or poverty, or materialism, or post-modernity, or militant Islam, or political correctness, or science and technology and the cynicism that goes with them, or now the rise of new atheism. All these powers bragging and boasting and making war on the people of God. And the point is that none of that underlines Daniel's vision. None of it takes away from the victory that he saw, because he saw this too. The other beasts were permitted to go on living, but only under certain conditions. First of all, for a limited time. Secondly, only after their power had been taken away. And thirdly, permitted. Not independent entities able to do what they want, but under God's jurisdiction, His providence, and His control. For how long? Doesn't tell us that. How much of their power was taken away? Don't know that either. These are the things that we cannot see, because we are here among them, looking out over the ocean, feeling the cold winds, the stormy blast, the icy sea, not yet able from where we stand to look into heaven and see the one who has taken his seat there. But we do know that Jesus Christ has been here. Do you remember him walking upon the waters and calming the storm? We do know that Jesus has been here, and we do know that Jesus is reigning there, and that God is in control. And what Daniel could give to the four centuries that followed him before Jesus came is the same thing that he gives to us today. And it's hope. In the name of Jesus Christ, that nothing can take away. I pray that God will follow with his blessing the reading and the teaching of his word, the picture that he revealed to Daniel, that he plants in our hearts and minds and gives us to live with today.